Welcome to the introduction for genomics panel. We'd like to thank the college for allowing us to present this very interesting panel. I'm Susan K. Boble, and I'm an associate professor of surgery at Mount Sinai downtown in New York City and Icahn School of Medicine. I'd like to introduce Dr. Lee Wilkie, who is the Hendricks Chair of Breast Surgery Research and Professor of Surgery at University of Wisconsin. Today we're going to have an exciting and relevant program highlighting the rapidly changing world of personalized breast treatment. We will start the session with Dr. Wilkie discussing genomics versus genetics, the basics. Thank you.
So thank you to everyone for joining us in this very large room. My job this morning is to do a little primer and introduction to the idea and differences when we're using the terminology of genomics and genetics. I have a financial relationship and founder of a company. I will not be discussing this technology today. So let's talk for a second about what is the difference when we talk about genetics versus genomics in terms of germline DNA abnormalities versus somatic alterations in a cancer. So germline alterations are those that we pass down to our family members, receive from our family members, and so my poor children have received my genetics, and this is germline DNA. These are abnormalities that I may have passed down to them based on received abnormalities from my parents. So what are somatic alterations? Well, somatic alterations are abnormalities in the actual cancer cells. They may not be alterations or abnormalities that are seen in all of our cells. And so I kind of think of cancer a little bit like teenagers, in that they are a similar genetic makeup to me, but I definitely think they have somatic alterations that make their cells occasionally go bad, especially their frontal lobes. Now, we have to remember in all of these discussions that there is more than just genetics and genomics. There is a whole progression from our genetic makeup into our proteins and metabolites, so to speak, such that there is also a wide array of investigation into not only genomics, but also transcriptomics, which is our mRNA, proteomics, what proteins are actually created from our DNA and RNA, and then the metabolites that are associated with these proteins. What we're discussing today is primarily genetics and genomics. So when I talk about germline or genetic changes, this is in every one of our cells. Could be mutations, could be deletions, and several other different abnormalities. So what are the known genetic germline mutations that we have right now for breast cancer? Kevin Hughes has created an excellent website called ask2me.org, or All Syndromes Known to Man. In this, he highlights the array of genetic abnormalities that can happen and or be associated with breast cancer. Those that we know the best are BRCA1 and 2. The increasingly identified ones are those that you see in the next set of bars of PALB2, CHEK2, and ATM. There are a wide array of other mutations, P53, that have smaller incidences, but as well an important impact. But what's the breast cancer risk associated with some of these mutations? They can be different for different families. We're learning that the actual pedigree matters in how to counsel our patients regarding outcomes. They can be different for different mutations in the same gene. It is important to look at the different abnormalities that are reported by the companies to recognize that, let's for say, CHEK2 mutations are not all the same. BRCA1 and 2 have the highest incidence of breast cancer, while those that follow can have either broad or narrow incidences of breast cancer. All Syndromes Known to Man is a helpful evaluator in you putting in the patient's actual mutation, if it's available on this list, and then looking at the potential risk for future breast cancers or other associated cancers depending on the syndrome. The NCCN obviously updates on an annual basis their genetic and familial high-risk assessment and provides recommendations regarding screening pathways dependent on the actual genetic mutation. So what are somatic mutations, or when we talk about genomic changes in a cancer? These, again, are mutations, deletions, or other changes that are actually inside the cancer cell. The ones we know the most about are the ones we've been evaluating and testing for the last 15, 20 years, that being estrogen and progesterone receptors, as well as HER2, i.e., there are normal cells that have HER2 receptors, but we are looking for upregulation of this DNA and subsequent protein on the cell surface when we're evaluating patients for their HER2 overexpression. There are really two categories of genomic testing. There are those that are prediction tools, which are a series of genes which, when evaluated together, can provide predictive or prognostic information on a patient's tumor and help guide or not the use of systemic therapy. Then there's whole tumor sequencing or next generation sequencing. This is an identification of mutations in the patient's cancer cells, recognizing there may be variable amounts of these mutations depending on the clonal variances that exist in the cancer, which may be actionable with therapies alone or in combination. Prediction tools are now utilized routinely in our practice for breast cancer patients and have been evaluated by the ASCO groups to determine which ones should be used and in which situations. These are the currently available multi-gene assays available for breast cancer use. We have Oncotype DX, MammaPrint, Breast Cancer Index, Prosigna, and EndoPredict. Some are FDA approved and others are not, as they're not required to be FDA approved. Each of them use a different number of genes, and the majority are applicable only to hormone-positive cancers, with MammaPrint being applicable to hormone-negative cancers. The NCCN level of evidence associated with each of these multi-gene assays is either 1 or 2A, and only one of them, that being the Oncotype DX, is both predictive and prognostic of the use of chemotherapy. Well, what's next-generation sequencing? This is sequencing the entire genome found within the cancer cell. You can do whole genome sequencing, which is about 3.4 billion base pairs, exome, which is the protein coding regions, which is only about 2% of our DNA, which is about 600 million base pairs, and then targeted or selected groups of genes with activity. I liken this to reading every medical textbook, just surgical textbooks, or just breast surgical oncology. So whole tumor sequencing is done by a series of companies and or individual labs within university settings. The one that is most well known is Foundation One. It looks at the entire coding sequence of 315 cancer-related genes with selected introns and provides information on specific agents and relevant clinical trials. Caris looks at the entire coding sequence of 592 genes and is an analysis platform, again, for therapeutic decision-making and associated clinical trials. The interesting thing about next-generation sequencing in breast cancer is that there are many breast cancers that have multiple mutations. Some don't have any mutations, and we don't have drugs for every mutation. So sometimes getting these results in patients can be challenging because though we might know the mistakes, so to speak, that were made in the cell, we don't necessarily have a therapeutic strategy for treating those mistakes. Thus, the evolution and increasing development of molecular tumor boards. These are primarily metastatic breast cancer patients that are presented at these molecular tumor boards, but they are designed to help patients and providers understand the molecular alterations that come out of the next generation sequencing results. For example, you could have an ERBB2 mutation, which occurs in about 2 to 4% of HER2 negative cancers, and right now the drug class associated for those mutations would be a HER2 TKI. You could have patients with a high tumor mutation burden, just a wide array of tumor mutations, which can occur in 1 to 5% of breast cancers, and these may be cancers that are more eligible and responsive to immune checkpoint inhibitors. The basket trials take this a little bit further. The one that's the most well known is the MATCH trial, supported and run by the NCI, looking at, again, next generation sequencing of a specific solid tumor and then treating that solid tumor with the drug that may target that actionable mutation. For example, it could be a breast cancer patient with an EGFR mutation, and therefore a lung cancer drug might be utilized. The future of our breast cancer treatment is really going to be revolves around systems biology. We're going to need to use the genotype or the genetic abnormality that exists in every patient's cells, but also look at the mutations and changes that happen within the cancer to generate and develop a treatment plan and algorithm for approaching our patients in a more personalized way. I thank you for your attention to this introductory primer and would like to now introduce our next speaker. I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Beth Mittendorf. She is the Rob and Karen Hale Distinguished Chair in Surgical Oncology, the Director of Research for the Breast Surgical Oncology Division, as well as Director of the Breast Immuno-Oncology Program for the Dana-Farber. Beth completed her medical degree and surgical residency at Case Western and then served our country in the military for 4 years. Her fellowship then followed at MD Anderson, where she was on staff for 9 years. She also obtained a PhD during that time. Quite clearly, I could never keep up. Her current and prior focus of her laboratory work is focused on the immunology of cancers and immunotherapeutic agents. She also has been intimately involved in developing the AJCC 8th edition, which is what she's going to speak to us on today.
All right, thanks, Lee, and thanks for the organizers for inviting me to give this talk. That's not mine. All right, there we go. So what I want to be discussing with you this morning is the 8th edition of the AJCC staging system for breast cancer. I don't have any relevant financial relationships, but I will disclose that I was a member of the panel that revised the AJCC breast cancer staging system. So my goals over the next 20 minutes are to review those revisions, discuss the rationale for incorporating tumor biology, which is the most significant change to the staging system, go over the data that's available regarding incorporation of genomic assays, and then speak a bit about what I think are future directions. Most are aware of the goals of staging. We stage patients to determine the extent of disease and inform prognosis. It helps us to determine a treatment plan. It does facilitate communication between providers. It allows us to get a standardized set of data that we can collect to inform our practice, and in some cases, it defines groups of patients for participation on clinical trials. This is a figure that kind of shows you how the staging system has evolved. So the first edition of the AJCC staging system was in the late 1970s, and it was a staging system based on the anatomic extent of disease alone, so TNM. We're all very familiar with this. You see through the years there's been multiple revisions. The first revision that incorporated non-anatomic factors was actually the 6th edition when our colleagues that look at GU malignancies added in serum markers for testicular tumors. And then you can see here with the 8th edition, we've made a fairly bold step by introducing the prognostic stage group in breast cancer. As I alluded to, we're all very familiar with the anatomic staging system that was the 7th edition, so T, primary tumor, and the presence of regional lymph node disease, and then M, looking for distant metastases. And you take those T, N, and M categories, put them together to get a stage, and then we can use the stage to determine a patient's prognosis. And this is just a figure from a paper we published a number of years ago that just confirms that, in fact, you can stratify patients with respect to prognosis by their AJCC stage. However, we know, as Lee just alluded to, that it's a lot more to breast cancer than just the anatomic extent of disease. There's an important role for tumor biology, and this is a landmark publication by Sorley in Peru, where they use transcriptomic analyses to identify clinically relevant gene expression profiles. And this is where we got the luminal A, luminal B, HER2 subtype, and basal-like breast cancers. And we know, in fact, that the biology impacts survival. So this is another figure from that manuscript that suggests that by using those different subtypes of breast cancers, we can inform overall survival as well as relapse-free survival. And so let's think about the clinic. So if I take a 49-year-old patient to the operating room and perform a segmental mastectomy and central lymph node dissection, the pathology report comes back as a 2.7-centimeter invasive ductal carcinoma. I obtained 3 central nodes, all negative for disease. So by the TNM stage, she's a pathologic T2 and 0. But I'm not going to call my medical oncology colleague and say I have a pathologic T2 and 0 patient to send you, because we all know, of course, the treatment recommendations and the prognosis for this patient really varies depending on their tumor biology. So is it hormone receptor positive, HER2 positive, hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative, hormone receptor negative, HER2 positive, or is it triple negative? And we know, of course, that these patients have different prognoses, and this is data that I published with my colleague Mariana Chavez-McGregor, where we looked at five-year breast cancer-specific survival according to subtype. So for that pathologic T2N0 patient that I just presented to you, you can see here a five-year breast cancer-specific survival rate of 96% if she's hormone receptor positive and HER2 negative, but only 88% of triple negative. An interesting observation in this work is that as you go up in stage, the difference in prognosis based on subtype actually gets larger. So for a patient with stage 4 disease, we found those who had hormone receptor positive tumors had a 47% five-year breast cancer-specific survival rate, which dropped to 17% for patients with triple negative disease. And so when we think back to the 7th edition AJCC staging system, there's some obvious limitations. As I just alluded to, patient survival shows wide variation within each stage because the stages do not take into account biologic factors that have both prognostic and predictive value. And of course, we're all well aware that treatment recommendations in response to that therapy are dictated not just by the anatomic extent of disease, but by the underlying tumor biology. And so when we were pulled together as a panel to revise the AJCC staging system, our charge was to make the staging system current or more relevant. And we very quickly decided that in order to do that, we needed to determine a way to incorporate biologic tumor markers to facilitate more precise determination of prognosis. Having made that decision, we were confronted with two issues. First, there's actually no level one evidence to suggest that ER, PR, HER2 grade are actually prognostic. The other consideration is that, in fact, there are low- and middle-income countries that may not have access to the assays and targeted therapeutics. I'm not going to make many more comments about that other than to say it was that observation that drove us to recommend that we maintain the anatomic staging system as the backbone. And, in fact, for countries in whom these assays are not available, then the anatomic stage alone is appropriate. For us in the U.S. and our cancer registrars, in fact, it is not adequate currently to stage just based on the anatomic extent of disease. So what data is available to inform staging based on biology? So this is some work that I was involved with when I was at MD Anderson, where we developed a novel staging system based on tumor biology. So we looked at about 3,300 patients with invasive disease treated between 97 and 2006. All of these patients underwent surgery as a first intervention. Their ER, PR, and grade were known, and we looked at five different staging systems. And you can see here that pathologic stage is one of them, and then pathologic stage was the backbone for the others. I don't have time to go into all the statistical analyses that were done, but long story short, we determined based on the hazard ratio for recurrence that we could assign points for each of these factors. And so what you do is you just sum the points based on this pathologic stage, the nuclear grade, and the ER status. And then by summing the points, you get a score, and the staging of patients with the using the pathologic stage grade and ER, so summing those scores, allowed for more precise stratification than if we were to stage based on the anatomic extent of disease, the pathologic stage alone. So this is a paper that was published in 2011. There were some obvious limitations. It was built using retrospectively collected data. This was a group of patients that we had treated standard practice, but treatment was not assigned as it would have been in a clinical trial. And most importantly, it predated the routine use of trastuzumab for our patients with HER2-positive disease. So when I was included onto the panel to revise the AJCC staging system, one of the first things they did was to give me homework. And the homework was to go back and update that staging system by incorporating patients with HER2-positive disease who received trastuzumab. So we did that. We had an experience now of about 3,300 patients, a little bit more contemporary, treated 2007 to 2013. And what we found was, in fact, that if you also assign points based on the HER2 status and now stratify patients by a staging system that incorporates the anatomic extent of disease, grade, ER, and HER2. We are, again, more refined with respect to prognosis than if we stage them based on the TNM categories alone. We were able to validate this in a cohort of 68,000 patients from the California Cancer Registry, where, again, we were using only patients who had surgery as a first treatment and were able to demonstrate that this, what we're now calling BioScore, could, in fact, stratify patients with respect to prognosis. While this was ongoing, my friend and colleague, Dr. David Winchester, who was also on the committee, was tasked with his homework assignment, which was to go to the NCDB data and see what that informed with respect to incorporating biology into staging. So David had a cohort of about 240,000 patients treated from 2010 to 2011. That year was chosen because that's the first year that they included HER2 status in the NCDB. He performed survival calculations based on the anatomic extent of disease, grade, hormone receptor, and HER2, and his findings were consistent with ours and other work showing, of course, that the prognosis varied within the TNM groupings based on biologic factors. So, in fact, that's what was used to inform this 8th edition prognostic stage. So the 8th edition prognostic stage group incorporates grade, ER, PR, and HER2 in addition to the T, N, and M categories. And as I'll focus on here for most of the remainder of my talk, we did include multi-gene panels as stage modifiers when available. As you all probably know, we now have over 150 groupings, and if you look at the chapter in the textbook from the AJCC, we have over 6 pages of tables for the 8th edition breast cancer prognostic stage. So this is just a snapshot from one of those tables just to kind of show you how it works. You've probably seen this. Basically, you identify what the tumor size is, and you work left to right when T is this, N is this, M is that, grade, HER2, ER, PR, and then you get to the far side there, and you can identify what the prognostic stage group is. So as I alluded to, the expert panel determined that it was appropriate to incorporate multi-gene molecular profiling. And the reason we thought it was appropriate is because these panels have clinical utility in selecting therapy. They're included in national guidelines to include from the NCCN and ASCO. And at the time we were making the staging system, which was the summer of 2016, we had level 1 evidence available for Oncotype DX recurrence score. And so just to remind you, the Oncotype DX is a genomic assay that looks at 21 genes. There's 5 housekeeping genes, 16 cancer-related genes, most of them related to proliferation. It was initially validated as a prognostic tool using a retrospective series from the NSABP-B14 trial, where it was demonstrated that a recurrence score could actually stratify patients with respect to their risk of distant recurrence. So the cutoffs for the assay, less than 18 is low risk, 18 to 30 intermediate, and greater than 31 is high risk. So what was the data that I was referring to that was level 1 data? Well, it came from the Taylor X trial. So this was published in the arm A of the trial was published in 2015. This was a study that enrolled over 10,000 patients, and patients in arm A were those who had a recurrence score of less than 11. So I just highlight here, for purposes of the trial, they actually changed those cutoffs for the recurrence score. Instead of 18 being the cutoff between low and intermediate, they used 11. So patients in arm A, recurrence score less than 11, they got hormonal therapy alone. And what they reported in 2015 was, in fact, a 5-year distant recurrence-free interval of 99.3% and an overall survival rate of 98%. So based on that data from arm A of Taylor X, when we were making the revisions to the staging system, we suggested that any patient with T1, T2, N0, hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative disease who had a recurrence score of less than 11 would be stage 1A. There's additional data to support inclusion of the Oncotype into the staging system. This is the experience from the Claylit Health Services. They looked at a 4-year period where they treated patients with hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative, node negative cancer, about 1,800 patients. In this table, you can see the breakdown. About 50% of folks had a recurrence score less than 18, so they were using the standard cutoffs for this initial analysis, 40%, 18 to 30, and about 10%, 31 or greater. You can see the use of chemotherapy and then the 5-year distant recurrence rate and the 5-year Kaplan-Meier estimate for breast cancer death. The rates are exceedingly low for the low-risk patient, again, supporting incorporation of the recurrence score into the staging system. This, then, is a reanalysis of the data where they actually went back and looked at their experience now using the Taylor X cutoffs. And you can see that for those who had a recurrence score less than 11, the 5-year risk of distant recurrence was 1%. There's additional data from the West German study group, the Plan B trial. This was another study that looked at the incorporation of the recurrence score into therapeutic decisions. I'm not going to go through the study in any detail, but what I will show you is that for the high-risk, node-negative patients, those who had a recurrence score of 0 to 11, their 5-year disease-free survival rate was 94%. And this is for patients who were treated with hormonal therapy alone. So, again, consistent data supporting the inclusion in the staging system. And finally, we have a very large experience from SEER, almost 40,000 patients, hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative, node negative, that had recurrence scores obtained. And for those who had a recurrence score of less than 18, the breast cancer-specific mortality rate was 0.4%. So once we made that staging system, I actually worked with a colleague to try to use data from MD Anderson as well as a population-based database to validate the prognostic stage. So we used the cohort of 3,300 patients treated in Houston. We compared the AJCC anatomic stage to the prognostic stage and found that we upstaged about 30% of patients, downstaged about 30%. The most significant finding in our analysis was, in fact, that we could not assign a prognostic stage in 14%. And this is because there were just combinations of TNM, ERPR, and HER2 that were not accounted for in the staging system. Similarly, we looked at a cohort of 55,000 patients from the California Cancer Registry. You can see the rates of upstaging and downstaging. And in this data set, we were unable to assign a prognostic stage for about 7%. So I actually took this information back to the committee. We weren't the only ones to bring it to the attention of the committee. Others had reported as well the inability to assign a stage. And so this afforded Dr. Winchester the opportunity to go back to the NCDB data set, now using a two-year period, 334,000 patients with a median follow-up of 42 months. And again, looking at three-year overall survival, was able to kind of revise this pathologic prognostic stage. And I point this out because we now have actually two prognostic stages. So if you have the textbook from the AJCC, the breast chapter is already out of date. We've had to revise it. And because it was, I'm going to say, our error, the updated or revised version is available on the AJCC website as a PDF at no charge. So what we now have is a clinical prognostic stage that's assigned to all patients, and it should be assigned prior to surgery or neoadjuvant therapy. We then have a pathologic prognostic stage. This applies only to patients who have surgery as their initial treatment. So it does not apply to patients who receive neoadjuvant systemic therapy. This pathologic prognostic stage is based on findings from the resected tissue and biomarker data. It does incorporate Oncotype DX. Again, if a score is less than 11, then the patient is stage 1A. And it is, as I alluded to, not applicable to patients receiving neoadjuvant therapy. So I give a talk like this not infrequently, and this is what I list as I think are important considerations. Multi-gene assays, the prognostic stage not being applicable to patients receiving neoadjuvant therapy, how will the changes be incorporated into guidelines, the impact on clinical trials and complexity. And for the purposes of our discussion today, I'm going to focus just a touch on the multi-gene assays. So here I believe the questions are there other assays that should be used? Should we use different cut points? And can we use in node-positive patients? And I'm going to show you a little bit of data to kind of inform the conversation that our committee is going to have as we move forward towards the ninth edition of the AJCC staging system. As I alluded to, when the initial chapter went to press, which was August of 2016, the only level one evidence was from Arm A of the TAILOR-X trial. Interestingly, the MINDAC trial reported out shortly thereafter, and I'm not going to go into too much detail about the trial because other speakers will, but very briefly, what this trial did was to look at the MammaPrint assay. So it used MammaPrint to determine a patient's genomic risk, high or low, and it used adjuvant online to determine the clinical risk, high or low. And for patients whose clinical and genomic risks were discordant, they were randomized to chemotherapy or not. And so the primary goal of the study was to assess whether among these clinical risk high, genomic risk low patients who did not get chemotherapy, was the lower boundary of the 95% confidence interval for the rate of five-year distant metastasis-free survival 92% or higher. And in fact, you can see here on the right that it was. The five-year rate was 94.7%, with the lower boundary of the confidence interval being 92.5%. So this is actually a positive study, level one evidence, not available when we first wrote the chapter, but was available when we had to revise the chapter. So we had a lengthy discussion about this when we were making our revisions. And at the end of the day, the panel decided not to incorporate MammaPrint for the two reasons listed here. First is that the clinical risk of recurrence, which is in MINDAC determined by Adjuvant Online, a tool that is actually no longer available for us to use. And there was also concern that MammaPrint did not predict benefit of chemotherapy. So even though that is level one data that became available to us, we chose not to incorporate it. And that's a discussion that I think will continue. The other question is that what other multi-gene assays besides MammaPrint, and this is a figure actually that Dr. Wilkie showed as well, the Breast Cancer Index, Prosigna, EndoPredict, we discussed all of these and we just didn't feel the data was mature enough to include into the staging system at this time. What about a different cut point? Well, I've shown you the schema for the TAILOR-X trial, and I emphasized Arm A, which was the recurrence score less than 11, hormonal therapy only. As you're probably aware, at ASCO this past year, the more interesting cohort, the cohort who had a recurrence score of 11 to 25, randomized to chemotherapy plus hormonal therapy or hormonal therapy alone, read out. And what you see here is the data basically suggests that for those with a recurrence score of 11 to 25, there is actually no benefit to chemotherapy. There's some nuances about the data related to patient age that I don't really want to discuss this morning. But bottom line, this actually suggests that that recurrence score less than 11, maybe we need to reconsider the cut point. Should it be higher? Should it be 25? And I would go back to the data from the Claylit Health Services experience. I just glossed over this earlier in my talk when I showed you that the 5-year risk for the recurrence score less than 11 was 1. But for the 11 to 25 who got hormonal therapy alone, you can see it's 1.3. So this data is actually very consistent with the TAILOR-X data, so something for our committee to consider. And finally, what about using it for node-positive disease? Many of you are aware of the RxPONDER trial that was overseen by the SWOG Cooperative Group looking at the use of Oncotype in patients with node-positive disease. That trial has completed accrual, but it'll be a couple years before it reads out. In the meantime, we do have some data from the Plan B trial. I've already shown you the figure for the high-risk node-negative patients shown on the left, but if you look at the node-positive patients, it actually had the exact same 5-year disease-free survival rate for the high-risk node-negative and node-positive with a recurrence score of 0 to 11. And certainly in our practice here at Dana-Farber, we feel very comfortable using the recurrence score in patients with very low-volume nodal disease. So another thing for the committee to discuss. I would conclude my comments by suggesting that the 8th edition of the AJCC staging system took a very bold step by incorporating tumor biology to allow us to provide more refined prognostic information for our patients. One of the most significant changes was, in fact, the inclusion of the Oncotype recurrence score. So for patients who are T1 to T2 N0, hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative, with a score of less than 11, they are stage 1A. And as I hope I've suggested, there is additional work that's required to further define how best to incorporate genomic assays into our staging system. Thank you.
Thank you. That was an excellent overview. Our next speaker, hopefully we'll get the correct talk. Yes. Our next speaker is Dr. Jennifer Goss, who is an associate professor of surgery at Brown, chief of surgery and director of the breast fellowship at Women and Infants Hospital. She received her medical degree at University of Maryland and completed her surgery residency at Temple. She has a variety of research interests, but is clearly a leader in the field of sexual function after breast cancer. Dr. Goss will be speaking to us about personalized breast cancer care, genomic clinical trials.
Well, I don't think you could have organized these talks in a better order. So after that great overview and some discussion about the trials, TAILOR-RX and MINDACT, I want to go through those with you just in a little bit more detail. I have no important disclosures. So breast cancer genomics we've heard about so far really focuses on a subgroup of breast cancer. It's the ER-positive and HER2-negative breast cancer, which is important because that is about two-thirds of our patients. And to take you back to an earlier time in my career, I remember a landmark trial changing the course of treatment for so many women, the NSCDP-B20, published in 1997, was a positive trial showing that we needed to consider chemotherapy for all women that were ER-positive and node-negative, regardless of their node status, regardless of grade, and regardless of treatment with endocrine therapy. That led to the NCI saying that we need to consider chemotherapy for women ER-positive, node-negative, greater than 1 centimeter. So fast forward about almost 10 years, genomic scores and profiles are developed that help us better understand how to prognosticate a woman's future as a breast cancer survivor. We've had a few profiles presented to us this morning. We're going to focus in my lecture on the Oncotype 21 gene genomic score for the reasons that Dr. Mittendorf said. Both Dr. Wilkie and Mittendorf mentioned, it's the one gene profile that's been correlated with chemotherapy responsiveness. So as you already heard, it was developed from B14 and then validated on B20 blocks. This publication is from 2004 from the New England Journal of Medicine, just in some more descriptive detail, talking about the 21 gene recurrence score found from paraffin-embedded tumors with RNA isolation and then quantifying the risk of recurrence in patients treated with tamoxifen who were node-negative and ER-positive. The recurrence score was studied in those 700 patients treated from B14 and then validated in B20, you saw a graph showing these survival rates for distant recurrence of 6.8%, 14.3%, and 30% discriminated by a low score, 0 to 18, an intermediate score between 18 and 31, and a high score greater than 31. So that was all good information, another prognostic tool, but the game-changing information was when this tool was able to predict chemotherapy benefit. So as you look at this table, panel A is the entire cohort of patients, but now in panel B, we see a separation of the women who were scored with the low-risk score, less than 18, and looking at B20, the trial that showed the 3% overall survival advantage, we can see there's no survival advantage in this low-risk cohort to receiving chemotherapy. The intermediate group, which was 134 patients, about 25% of the population, had an uncertain benefit from chemotherapy. You couldn't be demonstrated here, but the subgroup was small, and therefore the conclusion was it was uncertain. But there was a conclusive result shown in panel D where we can look at the high-risk score group and we can see that the benefit of chemotherapy was borne by this group, but in the original study diluted over the entire population. So with the publication of this study, we were now able to discriminate which women should benefit from chemotherapy and which women could safely avoid chemotherapy. And as we already heard, we needed to then better study the intermediate group. The low-risk group was sufficiently powered to give us a conclusive answer, as was the high-risk group, but the intermediate group risk was uncertain. So the TAILOR-RX trial was opened as a prospective randomized control trial for these intermediate-risk women. But as Dr. Mittendorf told you, and again, this is very important, the risk score was shifted from the original intermediate risk from 18 to 31 to 11 to 25. And that was clearly because we were doing a non-inferiority study. We were offering women less than standard treatment, and so therefore there was care and concern not to avoid omitting treatment in women who were at the higher end of the intermediate score. So again, it was a randomized controlled trial overseen by the NCI. Women in the age group, you can see, importantly, node negative, ER positive, and HER2 negative, and who underwent primary surgery. As we've described, there really were four groups. The group of interest are the intermediate score group, 11 to 25, who were randomized to endocrine therapy alone, and the group getting standard treatment would be chemo and endocrine therapy. Here, the high-risk group were those with a score over 25, not over 31, and they all received adjuvant chemotherapy and endocrine therapy. So the primary endpoint in this study is invasive disease-free survival, which includes freedom from recurrence of invasive disease, but also second primary cancer and death. Secondary endpoints are listed. The analysis was the study was powered with enough patients in the intermediate score group. Although the study included results on the entire cohort, it was powered to this group. It was a non-inferiority design. Again, that's the study design when you're beginning to omit therapy and wanting to make sure that your type 2 error is acceptably low. So here is the entire consort diagram for all of the study group. We're focusing on about 3,500 women in each group are randomized to treatment with endocrine therapy or chemotherapy and endocrine therapy in the intermediate score group. And you can see after exclusions that left us with about 3,000 patients in each group, with each group having women receive chemotherapy when they weren't recommended or not get chemotherapy when it was recommended. The results were reported as intent to treat, but also as treated results are reviewed as well. So these results that were presented and published earlier this year resulted in 6,700 patients with the intermediate score and then mean follow-up of 90 months for the invasive disease-free survival and 96 months for overall survival. The duration of endocrine therapy was 5.4 years, with 35% of women having more than 5 years of endocrine therapy. The primary chemotherapy modality was taxotere and Cytoxan, and about a third of patients received anthracyclines. Postmenopausal endocrine therapy was aromatase inhibitors, as one would expect, and premenopausal women primarily had tamoxifen, and just a small fraction of women had ovarian suppression. You can see that there was a low rate of non-adherence to treatment, which was more common in the chemotherapy group. So as we look at this large table, we're really just focusing on the group in the middle that look well matched to one another, and these are analyzed. I'm sure it's hard for you to read, for age, menopausal status, tumor size, grade of tumor, ERPR status, clinical risk as measured by adjuvant online, type of surgery, and chemotherapy being obviously different between the two groups since that was the intervention. So the results. We've heard this somewhat already, but we're going to go through the results in a little bit more detail because there was some concern about the results. So for the intermediate, now 11 to 25-year-old group, endocrine therapy was shown to be non-inferior to chemotherapy for invasive disease-free survival, but also for distant recurrence, distant and local regional recurrence, and overall survival. As I said, the results were analyzed as intent to treat, but this was consistent with as-treated analyses. So 9-year distant recurrence survival in the 11 to 25-year group was 5%. And then, as we heard, we also studied the less than 11 group. The initial report was a 3% distant recurrence rate, and now at this 9-year report, it's up to, I'm sorry, it was initially 1%, and now it's up to 3%. 24% of the events were distant recurrence. So here are the slides that we saw already where we can see the survival curves just literally overlap one another, looking at invasive disease-free survival and freedom from recurrence at a distant site, because indeed that is what we expect chemotherapy to possibly impact. So there was subgroup analysis, and we looked at these subgroups and saw no difference in the recurrence score subgroups overall, in tumor size, larger or smaller than 2 centimeters, separate from grade, clinical risk category as assessed by adjuvant online, and menopausal status. But when we decided to look at the risk score between 11 and 25 for women under 50, who were 34% of participants, we were able to find some differences. Just to review, 40% of women under 50 had a recurrence score less than 15, and there was no significant difference. But the balance of those patients, 1,330 patients, were less than 50 and had the recurrence score 16 to 25. And now when we look at that particular group, and we don't look at overall survival or invasive disease-free survival, instead we look at distant recurrence, you look at the recurrence score between 16 and 20, and at 5 years, the distant recurrence rate is different between the chemotherapy and endocrine therapy, favoring chemotherapy at 0.8% at 5 years and 1.6% at 9 years. A somewhat small, very small difference in the recurrence score 21 to 25, which clearly is in the intermediate score, even in the original study. The percent difference is now 3.2% and 6.5% at 5 and 9 years. And while those might seem like small numbers, remember it was that 3% overall survival advantage that was considered the success in V20. Again, there was no difference. Oh, not again. I'm sorry. There was no difference in overall survival in this risk score group. And again, for women 15 and less, the distant recurrence rate was acceptably low at 2%. So the conclusions in this paper are that the recurrence score may identify 85% of women with ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer treated with primary surgery who can be spared chemotherapy. As described here, women greater than 50 with a recurrence score less than 25, and women less than 50 with a recurrence score less than 15. For this group between 16 and 25 that we've discussed, the suggestion was that potentially their benefit from chemotherapy may be ovarian function cessation caused by chemotherapy, but this was not well captured in the study. So now I'm going to move on to this other different challenging topic, which is when you have a patient who has a genomic low-risk score, but your clinical intuition from all of your training tells you that patient is clinically high risk, which should guide the patient's treatment? And then more newly, in a patient who we would have considered clinical low risk and wouldn't have considered chemotherapy, should we do a genomic score to see if they should be treated with chemotherapy? And this is that MINDAC trial that we've heard already. MINDAC, standing for microarray node negative disease, may avoid chemotherapy. So again, another randomized controlled trial, this trial done primarily in the European Union with oversight by the EORTC, similar age group of patients, and starting out again with node-negative patients, but ultimately allowing node-positive patients to enroll based on some data that's been presented to us. The planned follow-up is for 10 and 15 years, but they've published their initial results 2 years ago. And this was aimed and targeted at the high clinical risk, low genomic score group, and randomizing patients, like our last trial, between chemotherapy and endocrine therapy versus endocrine therapy alone. In this study, they used adjuvant online for clinical risk. The genomic score was evaluated by the 70-gene MammaPrint panel, and the stratifications and other considerations are listed there. I won't read them to you. So endpoint and statistics. This study, instead of using invasive disease-free recurrence, looked at survival free from distant metastases, but then also used secondary endpoints that include overall survival and disease-free survival, as well as patients receiving chemotherapy. The analysis was, again, powered to look at that particular group of interest, the high clinical risk, low genomic score. Another non-inferiority is designed for the same reasons as the last trial. Another table should look similar to the previous table. We have the patients who are low clinical risk, low genomic risk, who are going to get endocrine therapy but be followed, and the high-risk patients will get chemotherapy. But our group of interest, again, in the middle here, with the high clinical low gene risk being about 1,500 patients that are randomized, and then the low clinical risk, high genomic score risk, who end up being about 500 patients, who were divided into two different groups. At the end, after the exclusions, roughly 600 patients in each group on the high clinical risk, and as I said, 250 in each group in the low clinical risk. Here are the distributions and demographics of the entire cohort. So looking at the low clinical risk, low genomic risk, I just want to note that that's where most patients fall. So these women are spared chemotherapy based on a low genomic score as well as a low clinical risk. And then the high clinical risk, high genomic risk continue on with chemotherapy, and our study group of interest is this group, which is a minority of the entire population. The median age, 55, you can see almost 80% of women were node negative, and the majority of women were ER positive, with a minority HER2 positive. Adherence to therapy wasn't perfect, but similar in both groups, with 85% of women in the high clinical risk getting the chemotherapy as assigned, not getting chemotherapy, versus the low clinical risk, high gene risk. And that's just, for some reason, I chose to show you that was these exclusions here, the patients who didn't follow their treatment as indicated. So these are, again, intent to treat results. And so we've seen these already today, but just to review it yet again, the study group that was high clinical, low genomic risk, looking at distant metastasis-free survival, the rate was 95.9 for the group treated with chemotherapy and 94.4 for the group treated without chemotherapy. So that was a 1.5% lower rate for not using chemotherapy, but the hazard ratio was not significant. In the other group, which is smaller, and again, this study wasn't powered for this other group, we saw the 95.8% survival with chemotherapy versus 95% without chemotherapy. This is then shown graphically here, and you've seen these already. This is survival without distant metastasis. You can see that chemotherapy showing that small difference in the high clinical risk, low genomic risk, and you can see overlap of the lines in the low critical risk, high genomic risk. Here's disease-free survival, and then overall survival. And these differences by hazard ratio were measured as not significant. So putting these two trials together, what we have learned is that the 21 gene recurrence score successfully discriminates risk and prognosis, but is also predictive of chemotherapy benefit. In the current trial studying the intermediate group, it was shifted to the left, and so now looking at the risk score 11 to 25, we can show that with risk scores less than 15, the recurrence score at 3% at 9 years shows no chemotherapy benefit. For women greater than 50, there's no chemotherapy benefit even up to a risk score of 25. And then for women under 50, there remains some uncertainty with suggestion of small benefits in the 16 to 25 risk score group. From the MIND Act trial, what we learned is that when there's discordance between your clinical risk and your genomic risk in either respect, we were not able to demonstrate benefit of chemotherapy beyond endocrine therapy. Thank you for listening to that complicated explanation. I hope it was helpful.
So our next speaker is Dr. Bridget Killily. She is an associate professor of surgery at Yale School of Medicine. She also serves as the chief of breast surgery and a director at the Simlow Cancer Center. She specializes in benign and malignant disease of the breast. She completed her medical degree at the University of Connecticut and surgical residency at St. Vincent's in New York. She then pursued a best fellowship at Beth Israel Medical Center in New York. She has been at Yale for the past 10 years and is widely published, and she's going to now speak to us on when not to obtain a genomic assay.
Thank you. Good morning. I'd like to thank the college for the opportunity to present to you this morning, and I'd like to thank the panel moderators for the very simple task of telling you all and convincing you when not to order a genomic assay, especially following such compelling evidence and data from my esteemed colleagues up here. But in any event, here we go. So while I do not have any financial disclosures, I do feel compelled to tell you that I strongly believe in the use of genomic assays and think that they have revolutionized the care of breast cancer patients and helped us shepherd in an era of personalized and precision medicine. That being said, I also think that as we learn more about the use of these tests, we can hopefully identify patients that do not need to have the testing. So as you've heard this morning, traditionally, the decision whether or not to recommend chemotherapy for breast cancer patients has been based on anatomic stage, grade, and other pathologic factors. In modern era, these recommendations are increasingly being based on both genomic assays, the risk of recurrence, the benefit of chemotherapy, but also equally importantly, patient preference and patient comorbidities. To this end, genomic assays can be used to help us identify patients who are truly going to benefit from adjuvant chemotherapy, as well as successfully spare patients who are not. I also think that it's important to order the right test for the right patient. Not every genomic assay, as you've heard, is indicated for similar patients. A good example of this, and the assay that I'll spend most of the rest of this talk discussing, is the 21-gene assay, mostly because it's the assay that we have the most evidence and long-term follow-up data looking at, but also because it's the most widely used test in the United States at this time. As you've seen, the 21-gene recurrence score uses the following genes, and hopefully you now understand why this test is clearly not indicated for ER-negative or HER2-positive patients. As we look to the updated staging guidelines, though, and we place more importance on the use of patient tumor biomarkers, we also have incorporated the use of genomic assays into guidelines and recommendations for treatment. We see this both from the NCCN and ASCO, and I'd like you to pay particular attention and remember that low cutoff score size of 5 millimeters for the NCCN and the low burden of disease in the lymph nodes. As recently as this month, the NCCN updated their guidelines for the use of genomic panels and have expanded the number of commercially available tests and the indications. Having said that, though, I return to the question, do all patients necessarily need to undergo genomic analysis of their tumor? Well, let's take a real-world example. Let's consider an 80-year-old woman who comes in with a screen-detected small cancer. She undergoes a core biopsy that reveals an invasive ductal carcinoma, ERPR-positive, HER2-negative, as is usual in this cohort. She's clinically node negative. Since we're following NCCN guidelines, she undergoes a lymphectomy without sentinel lymph node biopsy. The pathology reveals a small, 4-millimeter grade 1 ERPR positive HER2 negative cancer. Does this patient need a genomic test? Well, let's look at the available evidence, of which there is not a great deal. In this recent abstract from the ASCO meeting, the author looked using tumor registry data at patients with stage T1B tumors between the years of 2012 and 2017 at a single institution. They identified 73 patients who were ERPR positive, HER2 negative, and node negative. In this group, there were only 12 patients who received adjuvant chemotherapy. Of them, 9 had a recurrence score of greater than 25, and 3 had a recurrence score of less than 25. Interestingly, none of them had grade 1 disease, and all were grade 2. The author of this study provocatively concluded that perhaps for this cohort of patients with stage 1B disease, greater than or equal to 0.5 centimeters or 5 millimeters, perhaps with grade 1 disease, oncotype testing could be avoided since they were low risk. Let's go back to our patient and lower her age a little bit. If we now have a 65-year-old woman who presents with a screen-detected cancer, undergoes 8-core biopsy, which shows the same tumor markers, is also clinically node negative, now we take this patient to the OR and appropriately perform a sentinel lymph node biopsy. What if the pathology report shows the same tumor with the same tumor size, but now she has a micromet? What if this patient has one macromet? What if this patient has 3 out of 3 positive nodes? To help us answer this question, I think we can look at the TransATAC data, which, as you know, included a cohort of patients that were 25% node positive. I would pose to you that patients with more than 3 positive lymph nodes in this study, even with the lowest recurrence score, still had a 9-year risk of distant recurrence of 30% or greater. And I would argue that the utility of testing in this group of patients with multiple positive nodes is likely going to affect the recommendation for adjuvant chemotherapy. Well, how are you using this information in real-world practice? A recent study by Bowie et al. Last year in 2017 looked at the use of the Oncotype test in the NCDB. They identified node-positive, ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancers and wanted to assess the impact and the use of the Oncotype DX score. What they observed was that overall the recurrence score was obtained, the test was ordered, in about 20% of patients. Not surprisingly, this increased over the years of the study from 15% in 2010 to nearly a quarter in 2013, again, for node-positive patients. Unsurprisingly, the test was most commonly ordered in patients with N1 microscopic disease and least common in N2 and N3 disease. Over 12,000 patients were included in the study, over 90% of which had low or intermediate recurrence scores. Again, the use of chemotherapy in low-volume nodal disease patients varied by the recurrence score. And again, the study confirmed the data from the TransATAC trial demonstrating that patients with higher burden of nodal disease received chemotherapy regardless of recurrence score. So I would suggest to you that perhaps patients with more advanced nodal disease might not require Oncotype testing because they're going to receive chemotherapy regardless. Lastly, I think it's important to consider invasive lobular cancer. As we know, invasive lobular cancers tend to be ER positive and HER2 negative. As we also know, these tumors don't tend to respond particularly well to chemotherapy when it's given in the neoadjuvant setting. All right. Okay.
We see movement.
I can still see it.
Oh, you can see it.
She can see it.
We cannot see it.
I know. Oh, okay. Here we go. This is every speaker's nightmare. Should I keep going? Okay. Okay. We'll give it a minute. So while we wait, let's do a show of hands. How many of you order an Oncotype for node-positive patients? Interesting.
So it looks like the overwhelming minority.
The minority, yeah.
While we... How many surgeons order the genomic asset as opposed to medical oncologists? How many surgeons are ordering it?
Not a lot. In my computer. So clearly you all work with medical oncologists. How many have an agreement with the medical oncologist for reflex Oncotype testing? Yeah, more. All right, I think I'm going to finish up. All right. Yeah, I'm just going to, I don't have too much left. Okay, so talking about lobular cancers and whether there's a role for Oncotype testing in these patients. So if we look to a recent study by the group at Memorial, 15% of their invasive lobular cancers which we consider to be less aggressive or mixed type invasive lobulars were classified as high risk, and only 15% of pleomorphic lobular cancer, which we do consider to be more aggressive, demonstrated a high risk recurrence score. Another study by Tsai et al. Looked at the utility of Oncotype testing in patients with lobular carcinoma. They observed that cases with a high PR and low Ki-67 expression generally had recurrence scores within less than 21 and concluded that the Oncotype DX score was not necessary for majority of invasive lobular cancers. Finally, the group at Penn State recently demonstrated their experience varying the cutoff for recurrence score among patients with lobular cancers. They demonstrated no statistically significant difference in recurrence scores between invasive ductal and invasive lobular cancers if low and high risk categories were considered. So in summary, again, while I do believe that Oncotype testing plays an important role in the management of our breast cancer patients, I do think that there are certainly groups of patients, including those at the extremes of age, those with small T1A tumors that are ER positive and HER2 negative, larger triple negative cancers, HER2 positive cancers, elderly patients with multiple comorbidities, those with a high lymph node burden, and lobular cancers may be safely considered for the omission of this test. Thank you.
I will stop touching that. thank you for...
Yeah, we don't need the slides.
But can we get these mics on?
Yeah.
Okay, that would be great. Thank you for that very interesting panel, and Dr. Killily, thank you for completing it without your slides. It's open for discussion. Any questions?
Sorry, it's not so much a question as a statement. In my particular region, if I, as a surgeon, ordered the Oncotype DX test, the providers will not pay for it, and the patient gets stuck with the bill. And so that's why. In my particular region, it's specifically only paid for if the medical oncologist orders it. Because
really? So yeah. That's dictated by the insurance company?
Correct.
Because it's interesting, for genomic health, I know about a third of the tests are ordered by surgeons. So I was not aware that that was geographic with the insurance companies. Yes?
Two things. First is just a comment. You ask how many of us order Oncotype with lymph node positive. I order it for N1 disease.
Correct.
So just to clarify
right.
that. Next question I have, there's a lot of equations out there looking at whether or not you should order Oncotype based on, you know, putting all the factors into these equations. I'm around Pittsburgh. I use the McGee-Women's equation. And if it comes back with less than 18, they say you don't need to even order the Oncotype. Do any of you use those equations to determine whether or not to order Oncotype?
So I'm familiar with the equations, but to answer your question, no, we don't routinely use those. We have a reflex testing in place. I will just say anecdotally, sometimes we sit around tumor board before the test comes back and we kind of play a little game, see how close we get, or somebody will present. And so I think what you're alluding to is the fact that both our clinical judgment plus these algorithms that Pittsburgh and others have come up with actually get us reasonably close, which I think speaks to Bridget's comments about being thoughtful for who you order the test on and whether you're really going to use the information to inform your therapeutic decisions. I actually have a question, if I could. I'm wondering what percentage of the audience feels that having grade 3 disease would prevent you from ordering an Oncotype. So if you have a grade 3, show of hands, yes, I go ahead and still order the Oncotype. Okay, let me ask. Okay, so it's a small number. Yeah, you guys do. Yeah, so we just recently reviewed the NCDB experience and found that for grade 3 tumors, in fact, about 30% will come back as low risk. And so that's actually, we've recently changed our reflex testing criteria to include using the Oncotype for the grade 3, whereas there have been previous publications suggesting that the grade in and of itself was informative enough to just go ahead and make a decision regarding chemotherapy. And I just wanted to make the point that I don't think that to be true.
I agree. We do the same at our institution, and I also think it kind of reinforces this idea that without Oncotype testing, we're very bad at guessing who's going to come back low, intermediate, or high risk. And
I think we're good at it on the low end.
Right.
We're not good at it on the high end.
I agree.
I think we're, yeah.
Question to the panel. Given the Telerex data with the less than 50-year-old group, what happens if you have a woman who's 48 and menopausal? Do you still pay attention to that data? Because the thought is that maybe it has to do with the menopausal status. So she's postmenopausal now at 48. Are we still concerned?
I would interpret, I mean, I think the age was largely used as a surrogate for menopausal status. And so I think if you know their menopausal status and they're postmenopausal, then I would clearly feel comfortable omitting chemotherapy in that patient with 11 to 25 recurrent score.
Any other comments?
I would agree with that. And then I would just emphasize that age, like recurrent score, is a continuum. And so it probably, even when you talk about menopausal status, women will become postmenopausal with chemotherapy, but younger women won't. So age really remains this continuum.
And then on the same spectrum of that question, what happened if we have a 52-year-old woman who is premenopausal? What do we do there?
I think what we're highlighting is what the title of this talk is, that you need to personalize the therapy for the patient and recognize that if they're over 50 but premenopausal and they're on the border, that perhaps we recognize that based on the scoring, and the scoring is a continuum and probably not perfect. It's perfect for groupings, but not perfect patient by patient.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Can someone discuss, is there a role for genomics preoperatively? Will it change, other than BRCA testing, will it change decision for mastectomy or alternatively neoadjuvant treatment before surgery?
So I'd like to take that one because I feel pretty passionately about that as an opportunity. So for a while we were concerned that you could only do the Oncotype, as an example, on the surgically resected specimen, but in fact there's been data that's been put forward by Genomic Health to suggest that it's accurate to do it on the core. And I actually think for our hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative patients in whom we're trying to decide upfront surgery versus preoperative systemic therapy. And then when you think about preoperative systemic therapy, for me then the question becomes, well, should it be endocrine therapy or chemotherapy? Because if you don't choose that right, you may actually not get your biggest bang for your buck for us as surgeons to shrink it down and make the patient more amenable to breast conservation. So we actually have just instituted a prospective study at our institution for patients in whom we're considering systemic therapy. We're using the Prosigna assay because we have it at the institution, where we'll get the Prosigna assay and inform whether they would get preoperative endocrine versus chemotherapy. And actually, we're using it to feed our clinical trials program. So we have a preoperative trial looking at endocrine therapy with CDK4/6 inhibitor, and then we have another one that's looking at chemo plus immunotherapy. And so we're going to use it to help triage those decisions. So I think that's a real opportunity for these patients in whom you're kind of wrestling with whether they're going to, what systemic therapy they're even going to need.
So at our institution, sometimes we do get into discussions at our tumor board if we don't know the nodal status accurately of the patients. And I think we all have had situations where we have patients that are clinically node negative by both physical exam and on imaging, including sometimes MRI, that will, at the time of surgery, turn out to be node positive, and rarely N2 or N3, but it can happen, and I think sometimes, especially the medical oncologists, are a little wary of that, so I would just add that as a caveat.
And I would just add that the TransNeos trial was conducted in Japan using the Oncotype score to evaluate path CR, and more importantly, even a partial response to neoadjuvant endocrine therapy, and they were able to show that, as you would expect, but they did show that the Oncotype score, the lower stratified into low, intermediate, and high risk, the rate of response that you see after primary endocrine therapy was predicted by the Oncotype score.
Another question for the panel. As we move into genomics more and more, and not just for the adjuvant treatment or neoadjuvant treatment, do you foresee when we will no longer be classifying tumors as breast cancer or ovarian cancer, and more so, I hear giggles already from my panelists, and more so really by the genomics or the mutations of the cells? I see them all jumping at the microphones.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the pie in the sky, is that we understand...
I've been known to be pie in the sky sometimes.
I think that's the pie in the sky, is that we know the mutational changes associated with that cancer, the degree to which those mutational changes are dominant or inferior, and then can act upon that and act upon it as the cancer changes. But I think being able to do that in real time, rapidly, and have the associated treatment is not going to be easy.
I think the first place that'll take hold, and it already is, we see some data reported from the group at Memorial and Sloan Kettering and their IMPACT program, will be in the rare tumor types,
yeah,
where you are looking to test an abnormality or an agent targeting an abnormality, and you put on all your odd tumors. To your point, though, there actually was, when I was at MD Anderson, there was an effort with one of our initial moonshots to look at triple-negative breast cancer and serous ovarian cancer, because genetically or genomically, they look more alike than triple-negative looks like hormone receptor-positive breast cancer.
Right.
But then you've got two constituencies sitting there, and we do adjuvant therapy, and they do consolidative therapy, and we surgically resect, and they surgically debulk. And so there's just so many differences. It would be a real paradigm change to try to cross over.
The whole thought is a paradigm shift, yes. Yes, sir.
How would internal mammary node involvement affect your decision for genomic testing?
That's going to be N2 disease, so for me, it would probably make me more inclined to move towards chemotherapy, and then certainly it has impact into the recommendations for radiation therapy.
I would agree. Certainly hard when a patient has what appears to be axillary negative disease in an enlarged IM node, and it's always hard to know whether that was from a biopsy. If it was, it is not something that's going to be easy to solve, but if it appears suspicious, then we would consider it N2 disease.
Other questions from the panel?
No, I think, you know, what we've talked primarily about are the prognostic and predictive genomic assays, but the whole genome sequencing or selective genome sequencing for the treatment of cancers is the next phase, and how we're going to utilize that for treatment of both our metastatic patients as well as our primary patients is what's going to be happening in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, I think this certainly is the present and the future. Okay. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Enjoy the day.
Thank you.